Penguin Random House Audio presents In the Heart of the Sea, The Tragedy of the Whale Ship Essex by Nathaniel Philbrick. Read for you by Scott Brick. And in the greatness of thine excellency thou hast overthrown them that rose up against thee. Thou sentest forth thy wrath which consumed them as stubble. And with the blast of thy nostrils the waters were gathered together, the floods stood upright as a heap, and the depths were congealed in the heart of the sea. Exodus chapter 15, verse 7 through 8. This is the end of the whale road and the whale, who spewed Nantucket bones in the thrashed swell. This is the end of running on the waves. We are poured out like water. Who will dance, the mast-lashed master of leviathans, up from this field of Quakers in their unstoned graves? Robert Lowell, The Quaker Graveyard in Nantucket. Preface, February 23, 1821. Like a giant bird of prey, the whale ship moved lazily up the western coast of South America, zigging and zagging across a living sea of oil. For that was the Pacific Ocean in 1821, a vast field of warm-blooded oil deposits known as sperm whales. Harvesting sperm whales, the largest toothed whales in existence, was no easy matter. Six men would set out from the ship in a small boat, row up to their quarry, harpoon it, then attempt to stab it to death with a lance. The 60-ton creature could destroy the whale but with a flick of its tail, throwing the man into the cold ocean water, often miles from the ship. Then came the prodigious task of transforming a dead whale into oil, ripping off its blubber, chopping it up, and boiling it into the high-grade oil that lit the streets and lubricated the machines of the industrial age. That all of this was conducted on the limitless Pacific Ocean meant that the whalemen of the early 19th century were not merely seagoing hunters and factory workers, but also explorers, pushing out farther and farther into a scarcely charted wilderness larger than all the Earth's land masses combined. For more than a century, the headquarters of this global oil business had been a little island called Nantucket, 24 miles off the coast of southern New England. One of the defining paradoxes of Nantucket's whalemen was that many of them were Quakers, a religious sect stoically dedicated to pacifism, at least when it came to the human race. Combining rigid self-control with an almost holy sense of mission, these were what Herman Melville would call Quakers with a vengeance. It was a Nantucket whale ship, the Dauphin, just a few months into what would be a 3-year voyage that was making her way up the Chilean coast. And on that February morning in 1821, the lookout saw something unusual. A boat, impossibly small for the open sea, bobbing on the swells. The ship's captain, the 37-year-old Zimri Coffin, trained his spyglass on the mysterious craft with keen curiosity. He soon realized that it was a whaleboat, double-ended and about 25 feet long, but a whaleboat unlike any he had ever seen. The boat's sides had been built up by about half a foot. Two makeshift masts had been rigged, transforming the rowing vessel into a rudimentary schooner. The sails, stiff with salt and bleached by the sun, had clearly pulled the boat along for many, many miles. Coffin could see no one at the steering oar. He turned to the man at the Dauphin's wheel and ordered, "Hard up the helm." Under Coffin's watchful eye, the helmsman brought the ship as close as possible to the derelict craft. Even though their momentum quickly swept them past it, the brief seconds during which the ship loomed over the open boat presented a sight that would stay with the crew the rest of their lives. First, they saw bones, human bones, littering the thwarts and floorboards, as if the whaleboat were the seagoing lair of a ferocious, man-eating beast. Then they saw the two men. They were curled up in opposite ends of the boat, their skin covered with sores, their eyes bulging from the hollows of their skulls, their beards caked with salt and blood. They were sucking the marrow from the bones of their dead shipmates. Instead of greeting their rescuers with smiles of relief, the survivors, too delirious with thirst and hunger to speak, were disturbed, even frightened. They jealously clutched the splintered and gnawed over bones with a desperate, almost feral intensity, refusing to give them up, like two starving dogs found trapped in a pit. Later, once the survivors had been given some food and water and had finally surrendered the bones, one of them found the strength to tell his story. It was a tale made of a whaleman's worst nightmares, of being in a boat far from land with nothing left to eat or drink, and perhaps worst of all, of a whale with the vindictiveness and guile of a man. Even though it is little remembered today, the sinking of the whale ship Essex by an enraged sperm whale was one of the most well-known marine disasters of the 19th century. Nearly every child in America read about it in school. It was the event that inspired the climactic scene of Herman Melville's Moby Dick. But the point at which Melville's novel ends, the sinking of the ship, was merely the starting point for the story of the real-life Essex disaster. The sinking seemed to mark the beginning of a kind of terrible laboratory experiment devised to see just how far the human animal could go in its battle against the savage sea. Of the 20 men who escaped the whale-crushed ship, only 8 survived. The 2 men rescued by the Dauphin had sailed almost 4,500 nautical miles across the Pacific, farther by at least 500 miles than Captain William Bligh's epic voyage in an open boat after being abandoned by the Bounty mutineers, and more than 5 times farther than Sir Ernest Shackleton's equally famous passage to South Georgia Island. For nearly 180 years, most of what was known about the calamity came from the 128-page Narrative of the Wreck of the Whaleship Essex, written by Owen Chase, the ship's first mate. Fragmentary accounts from other survivors existed, but these lacked the authority and scope of Chase's narrative, which was published with the help of a ghostwriter only 9 months after the first mate's rescue. Then around 1960, an old notebook was found in the attic of a home in Penn Yan, New York. Not until 20 years later, in 1980, when the notebook reached the hands of the Nantucket whaling expert, Edward Stackpole, was it realized that its original owner, Thomas Nickerson, had been the Essex's cabin boy. Late in life, Nickerson, then the proprietor of a boarding house on Nantucket, had been urged to write an account of the disaster by a professional writer named Leon Lewis, who may have been one of Nickerson's guests. Nickerson sent Lewis the notebook containing his only draft of the narrative in 1876. For whatever reason, Lewis never prepared the manuscript for publication and eventually gave the notebook to a neighbor, who died with it still in his possession. Nickerson's account was finally published as a limited edition monograph by the Nantucket Historical Association in 1984. In terms of literary quality, Nickerson's narrative cannot compare to Chase's polished account. Ragged and meandering, the manuscript is the work of an amateur, but an amateur who was there at the helm of the Essex when she was struck by the whale. At 14, Nickerson had been the youngest member of the ship's crew, and his account remains that of a wide-eyed child on the verge of manhood, of an orphan. He lost both his parents before he was 2, looking for a home. He was 71 when he finally put pen to paper, but Thomas Nickerson could look back to that distant time as if it were yesterday, his memories bolstered by information he'd learned in conversations with other survivors. In the account that follows, Chase will get his due, but for the first time his version of events is challenged by that of his cabin boy, whose testimony can now be heard 180 years after the sinking of the Essex. When I was a child, my father, Thomas Philbrick, a professor of English at the University of Pittsburgh and author of several books about American sea fiction, often put my brother and me to bed with the story of the whale that attacked a ship. My uncle, the late Charles Philbrick, winner of the Wallace Stevens Poetry Prize in 1958, wrote a 500-line poem about the Essex, A Travail Past, published posthumously in 1976. It powerfully evoked what he called a past we forget that we need to know. 10 years later, as it happened, in 1986, I moved with my wife and 2 children to the Essex's home port, Nantucket Island. I soon discovered that Owen Chase, Herman Melville, Thomas Nickerson, and Uncle Charlie were not the only ones to have written about the Essex. There was Nantucket's distinguished historian, Edward Stackpole, who died in 1993, just as my own research was beginning. There was Thomas Heffernan, author of Stove by a Whale, Owen Chase, and the Essex, 1981, an indispensable work of scholarship that was completed just before the discovery of the Nickerson manuscript. Finally, there was Henry Carlyle's compelling novel, The Jonah Man, 1984, which tells the story of the Essex from the viewpoint of the ship's captain, George Pollard. Even after I'd read these accounts of the disaster, I wanted to know more. I wondered why the whale had acted as it did, how starvation and dehydration had affected the men's judgment. What had happened out there? I immersed myself in the documented experiences of other whalemen from the era. I read about cannibalism, survival at sea, the psychology and physiology of starvation, navigation, oceanography, the behavior of sperm whales, the construction of ships, anything that might help me better understand what these men experienced on the wide and unforgiving Pacific Ocean. I came to realize that the Essex disaster had provided Melville with much more than an ending to one of the greatest American novels ever written. It had spoken to the same issues of class, race, leadership, and man's relationship to nature that would occupy him throughout Moby Dick. It had also given Melville an archetypal but real place from which to launch the imaginary voyage of the Pequod, a tiny island that had once commanded the attention of the world. Relentlessly acquisitive, technologically advanced, and with a religious sense of its own destiny, Nantucket was, in 1821, what America would become. No one dreamed that in a little more than a generation the island would founder, done in, like the Essex, by a too close association with the whale. Crew of the Essex. Captain, George Pollard, Jr. First Mate, Owen Chase. Second Mate, Matthew Joy. Boat Steerers, Benjamin Lawrence, Obed Hendricks, Thomas Chappell. Steward, William Bond. Sailors, Owen Coffin, Isaac Cole, Henry DeWitt, Richard Peterson, Charles Ramsdell, Barzillai Ray, Samuel Reed, Isaiah Shepherd, Charles Shorter, Lawson Thomas, Seth Weeks, Joseph West, William Wright, Cabin Boy, Thomas Nickerson. Chapter 1. Nantucket. It was, he later remembered, the most pleasing moment of my life, the moment he stepped aboard the whale ship Essex for the first time. He was 14 years old, with a broad nose and an open, eager face, and like every other Nantucket boy, he'd been taught to idolize the form of a ship. The Essex might not look like much, stripped of her rigging and chained to the wharf, but for Thomas Nickerson, she was a vessel of opportunity. Finally, after what had seemed an endless wait, Nickerson was going to sea. The hot July sun beat down on her old, oil-soaked timbers until the temperature below was infernal, but Nickerson explored every cranny, from the brick altar of the tryworks being assembled on deck to the lightless depths of the empty hold. In between was a creaking, compartmentalized world, a living thing of oak and pine that reeked of oil, blood, tobacco juice, food, salt, mildew, tar, and smoke. Black and ugly as she was, Nickerson wrote, I would not have exchanged her for a palace. In July of 1819, the Essex was one of a fleet of more than 70 Nantucket whale ships in the Pacific and Atlantic Oceans. With whale oil prices steadily climbing and the rest of the world's economy sunk in depression, the village of Nantucket was on its way to becoming one of the richest towns in America. The community of about 7,000 people lived on a gently sloping hill crowded with houses and topped by windmills and church towers. It resembled, some said, the elegant and established port of Salem, a remarkable compliment for an island more than 20 miles out into the Atlantic, below Cape Cod. But if the town, high on its hill, radiated an almost ethereal quality of calm, the waterfront below bustled with activity. Sprouting from among the long, low warehouses and rope walks, four solid fill wharves reached out more than 100 yards into the harbor. Tethered to the wharves or anchored in the harbor were typically 15 to 20 whale ships, along with dozens of smaller vessels, mainly sloops and schooners, that brought trade goods to and from the island. each wharf a labyrinth of anchors, tripods, spars, and oil casks, was thronged with sailors, stevedores, and artisans. Two-wheeled, horse-drawn carts known as calashes continually came and went. It was a scene already familiar to Thomas Nickerson. The children of Nantucket had long used the waterfront as their playground. They rowed decrepit whaleboats up and down the harbor and clambered up into the rigging of the ships. To off-islanders, it was clear that these children were a distinctive class of juveniles, accustomed to consider themselves as predestined mariners. They climbed ratlines like monkeys, little fellows of 10 or 12 years, and laid out on the yardarms with the most perfect nonchalance. The Essex might be Nickerson's first ship, but he had been preparing for the voyage almost his entire life. He wasn't going alone. His friends Barzillai Ray, Owen Coffin, and Charles Ramsdell, all between the ages of 15 and 18, were also sailing on the Essex. Owen Coffin was the cousin of the Essex's new captain and probably steered his three friends to his kinsman's ship. Nickerson was the youngest of the group. The Essex was old, and at 87 feet long and 238 tons displacement, quite small, but she had a reputation on Nantucket as a lucky ship. Over the last decade and a half, she had done well by her Quaker owners, regularly returning at two-year intervals with enough oil to make them wealthy men. Daniel Russell, her previous captain, had been successful enough over the course of four voyages to be given command of a new and larger ship, the Aurora. Russell's promotion allowed the former first mate, George Pollard Jr., to take over command of the Essex, and one of the boat steerers, or harpooners, Owen Chase, to move up to first mate. Three other crew members were elevated to the rank of boat steerer. Not only a lucky, but apparently a happy vessel, the Essex was, according to Nickerson, on the whole, rather a desirable ship than otherwise. Since Nantucket was, like any seafaring town of the period, a community obsessed with omens and signs, such a reputation counted for much. Still, there was talk among the men on the wharves when earlier that July, as the Essex was being repaired and outfitted, a comet appeared in the night sky. Nantucket was a town of roof dwellers. Nearly every house, its shingles painted red or left to weather into gray, had a roof-mounted platform known as a wok. While its intended use was to facilitate putting out chimney fires with buckets of sand, the wok was also an excellent place to look out to sea with a spyglass, to search for the sails of returning ships. At night, the spyglasses of Nantucket were often directed toward the heavens, and in July of 1819, islanders were looking toward the northwest sky. The Quaker merchant Obed Macy, who kept meticulous records of what he determined were the most extraordinary events in the life of his island, watched the night sky from his house on Pleasant Street. The comet, which appears every clear night, is thought to be very large from its uncommonly long tail, he wrote, which extends upward in opposition to the sun in an almost perpendicular direction and heaves off to the eastward and nearly points for the North Star. From earliest times, the appearance of a comet was interpreted as a sign that something unusual was about to happen. The New Bedford Mercury, the newspaper Nantucketers read for lack of one of their own, commented, "True it is that the appearance of these eccentric visitors have always preceded some remarkable event." But Macy resisted such speculation. The philosophical reasoning we leave to the scientific part of the community, still it is beyond a doubt that the most learned is possessed of very little undoubted knowledge of the subject of cometics. At the wharves and shipping offices there was much speculation, and not just about the comet. All spring and summer there had been sightings up and down the New England coast of what the Mercury described as an extraordinary sea animal, a serpent with black, horse-like eyes and a 50-foot body resembling a string of barrels floating on the water. Any sailor, especially if he was young and impressionable like Thomas Nickerson, must have wondered, if only fleetingly, if this was in fact the best time to be heading out on a voyage around Cape Horn. Nantucketers had good reason to be superstitious. Their lives were governed by a force of terrifying unpredictability, the sea. Due to a constantly shifting network of shoals, including the Nantucket Bar just off the harbor mouth, the simple act of coming to and from the island was an often harrowing and sometimes catastrophic lesson in seamanship. Particularly in winter, when storms were the most violent, Wrecks occurred almost weekly. Buried throughout the island were the corpses of anonymous seamen who had washed up on its wave-thrashed shores. Nantucket, which means faraway land in the language of the island's native inhabitants, the Wampanoag, was a mound of sand eroding into an inexorable ocean, and all its residents, even if they had never left the island, were all too aware of the inhumanity of the sea. Nantucket's English settlers, who began arriving in 1659, had been mindful of the sea's dangers. They had hoped to support themselves not as fishermen, but as farmers and sheepherders on this grassy, pond-speckled crescent without wolves. But as the increasing size of the livestock herds, combined with the growing number of farms, threatened to transform the island into a wind-blown wasteland, Nantucketers inevitably looked seaward. Every fall, hundreds of right whales appeared to the south of the island and remained until the early spring. So named because they were the right whale to kill, right whales grazed the waters off Nantucket much like seagoing cattle, straining the nutrient-rich surface of the ocean through the bushy plates of baleen in their perpetually grinning mouths. While English settlers at Cape Cod and eastern Long Island had already been hunting right whales for decades, no one on Nantucket had had the courage to pursue the whales in boats. Instead, they left the harvesting of whales that washed up onto the shore, known as drift whales, to the Wampanoag. Around 1690, a group of Nantucketers was standing on a hill overlooking the ocean where some whales were spouting and playing with one another. One of the onlookers nodded toward the whales in the ocean beyond. "There," he asserted, "is a green pasture where our children's grandchildren will go for bread." In fulfillment of his prophecy, a Cape Codder by the name of Ichabod Paddock was soon thereafter lured across Nantucket Sound to instruct the islanders in the art of killing whales. Their first boats were only 20 feet long, and they launched them from the beaches along the island's south shore. Typically, a whaleboat's crew was comprised of 5 Wampanoag oarsmen with a single white Nantucketer at the steering oar. Once they'd killed the whale, they towed it back to the beach, where they removed the blubber and boiled it into oil. By the beginning of the 18th century, English Nantucketers had instituted a system of debt servitude that provided them with a steady supply of Wampanoag labor. Without the island's native inhabitants, who outnumbered Nantucket's white population well into the 1720s, the island would never have become a successful whaling port. In the year 1712, a Captain Hussey, cruising in his little boat for right whales along Nantucket's south shore, was blown out to sea in a fierce northerly gale. Many miles out, he glimpsed several whales of a type he had never seen before. Unlike a right whale's vertical spout, this whale's spout arched forward. In spite of the high winds and rough seas, Hussey managed to harpoon and kill one of the whales, its blood and oil stilling the waves in an almost biblical fashion. This creature, Hussey quickly realized, was a sperm whale, one of which had washed up on the island's southwest shore only a few years before. Not only was the oil derived from the sperm whale's blubber far superior to that of the right whale, providing a brighter and cleaner burning light, but its block-shaped head contained a vast reservoir of even better oil, called spermaceti, that could be simply ladled into an awaiting cask. It was spermaceti's resemblance to seminal fluid that gave rise to the sperm whale's name. The sperm whale might be faster and more aggressive than the right whale, but it was far more enriching. With no other means of support, Nantucketers dedicated themselves to the single-minded pursuit of the sperm whale, and they soon outstripped their whaling rivals on the mainland and Long Island. By 1760, the Nantucketers had practically wiped out the local whale population. But no matter. By that point, they had enlarged their whaling sloops and equipped them with brick tryworks capable of processing the oil on the open ocean. Now, since it would not need to return to port as often to deliver bulky blubber, their fleet had a far greater range. By the outbreak of the American Revolution, Nantucketers had made it to the verge of the Arctic Circle, to the west coast of Africa, the east coast of South America, and as far south as the Falkland Islands. In a speech before Parliament in 1775, the British statesman Edmund Burke looked to the island's inhabitants as the leaders of a new American breed, a recent people whose success in whaling had exceeded the collective might of all of Europe. Living on an island that was almost the same distance from the mainland as England was from France, Nantucketers developed a British sense of themselves as a distinct and superior people, privileged citizens of what Ralph Waldo Emerson called the nation of Nantucket. The Revolution and the War of 1812, when the British Navy marauded offshore shipping, proved disastrous to the whale fishery. Fortunately, Nantucketers possessed enough capital and inherent whaling expertise to survive these trials. By 1819, Nantucket was well on its way to reclaiming and, as the whalers ventured into the Pacific, even surpassing its former glory. But the rise of the Pacific sperm whale fishery had an unfortunate side effect. Instead of voyages that had once averaged about 9 months, 2- and 3-year voyages had become the norm. Never before had the division between Nantucket's whalemen and their people been so great. Long gone were the days when Nantucketers could watch from shore as the men and boys of the island pursued the whale. Nantucket was now the whaling capital of the world, but there were more than a few islanders who had never even seen a whale. In the summer of 1819, people were still talking about the time when, 9 years earlier, a pod of right whales was spotted to the north of the island. Whaleboats were quickly dispatched. A crowd gathered on shore to watch in fascination as 2 whales were killed and towed back into the harbor. For the people of Nantucket, it was an epiphany. Here, at last, were 2 of the creatures they had heard so much about, creatures upon which their livelihood depended. One of the whales was pulled up onto the wharf, and before the day was out, thousands of people, including perhaps the 5-year-old Thomas Nickerson, had come to see it. One can only imagine the intensity of the Nantucketers' curiosity as they peered at the giant creature and poked and prodded it and said to themselves, "So this is it." Nantucket had created an economic system that no longer depended on the island's natural resources. The island's soil had long since been exhausted by overfarming. Nantucket's large Wampanoag population had been reduced to a handful by epidemics, forcing ship owners to look to the mainland for crew. Whales had almost completely disappeared from local waters. And still, the Nantucketers prospered. As one visitor observed, the island had become a barren sandbank, fertilized with whale oil only. Throughout the 17th century, English Nantucketers resisted all attempts to establish a church on the island, partly because a woman by the name of Mary Coffin Starbuck forbade it. It was said that nothing of consequence was done on Nantucket without Mary's approval. Mary Coffin and Nathaniel Starbuck had been the first English couple to be married on the island in 1662, and had established a lucrative outpost for trading with the Wampanoag. Whenever an itinerant minister came to Nantucket looking to establish a congregation, he was firmly rebuffed by Mary Starbuck. Then in 1702, Mary succumbed to a charismatic Quaker minister named John Richardson. Speaking before a group assembled in the Starbucks living room, Richardson succeeded in moving Mary to tears. It was Mary Starbucks' conversion to Quakerism that established the unique fusion of spirituality and covetousness that would make possible Nantucket's rise as a whaling port. Quakers, or more properly, members of the Society of Friends, depended on their own experience of God's presence, the inner light, for guidance rather than relying on a Puritan minister's interpretation of Scripture. But Nantucket's ever-growing number of Quakers were hardly free-thinking individuals. Friends were expected to conform to rules of behavior determined during yearly meetings, encouraging a sense of community that was as carefully controlled as that of any New England society. If there was a difference, it was the Quaker belief in pacifism and a conscious spurning of worldly ostentation, two principles that were not intended to interfere in any way with a person's ability to make money. Instead of building fancy houses or buying fashionable clothes, Nantucket's Quakers reinvested their profits in the whale fishery. As a result, they were able to weather the downturns that laid to waste so many mainland whaling merchants, and Mary Starbuck's children, along with their Macy and Coffin cousins, quickly established a Quaker whaling dynasty. Nantucketers saw no contradiction between their livelihood and their religion. God himself had granted them dominion over the fishes of the sea. Peleg Folger, a Nantucket whaleman turned Quaker elder, expressed it in verse. Thou didst, O Lord, create the mighty whale, that wondrous monster of a mighty length. Vast is his head and body, vast his tail, beyond conception his unmeasured strength. But, everlasting God, thou dost ordain that we, poor feeble mortals, should engage, ourselves, our wives, and children to maintain this dreadful monster with a martial rage. Even if Nantucket's Quakers dominated the island economically and culturally, room was made for others, and by the early 19th century there were two congregational church towers bracketing the town north and south. Yet all shared in a common, spiritually infused mission: to maintain a peaceful life on land while raising bloody havoc at sea. Pacifist killers, plain-dressed millionaires, the whalemen of Nantucket were simply fulfilling the Lord's will. The town that Thomas Nickerson knew had a ramshackle feel about it. All it took was one walk through its narrow, sandy streets to discover that despite the stately church towers and the occasional mansion, Nantucket was a far cry from Salem. The good citizens of Nantucket do not seem to pride themselves upon the regularity of their streets or the neatness of their sidewalks, observed a visiting Quaker. The houses were shingled and unpretentious, and, as often as not, included items scavenged from ships. Hatchways make very convenient bridges for gutters. A plank from the stern of a ship, having the name on it, answers the double purpose of making a fence, and informing the stranger, if he can be at a loss, in what town he is. Instead of using the official street names that had been assigned for tax purposes in 1798, Nantucketers spoke of Elisha Bunker's Street or Captain Mitchell's. The inhabitants lived together like one great family, wrote the Nantucketer, Walter Folger, who happened to be a part owner of the Essex. Not in one house, but in friendship. They not only know their nearest neighbors, but each one knows all the rest. If you should wish to see any man, you need but ask the first inhabitant you meet, and he will be able to conduct you to his residence, to tell what occupation he is of, and any other particulars you may wish to know. But even within this close-knit familial community there were distinctions, and Thomas Nickerson was on the outside looking in. The unhappy truth was that while Nickerson's mother, Rebecca Gibson, was a Nantucketer, his father, Thomas Nickerson, had been from Cape Cod, and Thomas Jr. had been born in Harwich in 1805. 6 months later his parents moved him and his sisters across the Sound to Nantucket. It was 6 months too late. Nantucketers took a dim view of off-islanders. They called them strangers, or even worse, coofs, a term of disparagement originally reserved for Cape Codders, but broadened to include all of those unlucky enough to have been born on the mainland. It might have earned Thomas Nickerson some regard on the island if his mother had at least come from old Nantucket stock, with a last name like Coffin, Starbuck, Macy, Folger, or Gardner. Such was not the case. On an island where many families could claim direct descent from one of the 20 or so first settlers, the Gibsons and Nickersons were without the network of cousins that sustained most Nantucketers. Perhaps there is not another place in the world of equal magnitude, said Obed Macy, where the inhabitants are so connected by consanguinity as in this, which adds much to the harmony of the people and to their attachment to the place. Nickerson's friends and shipmates Owen Coffin, Charles Ramsdell, and Barzillai Ray could count themselves as part of this group. Thomas might play with them, go to sea with them, but deep down he understood that no matter how hard he might try, he was at best only a coof. Where a person lived in Nantucket depended on his station in the whaling trade. If he was a ship owner or merchant, he more than likely lived on Pleasant Street, set back on the hill, farthest from the clamor and stench of the wharves. In subsequent decades, as their ambitions required greater space and visibility, these worthies would gravitate toward Main Street. Captains, in contrast, tended to choose the thoroughfare with the best view of the harbor, Orange Street. With a house on the east side of Orange, a captain could watch his ship being outfitted at the wharf and keep track of activity in the harbor. Mates, as a rule, lived at the foot of this hill, under the bank it was called, on Union Street, in the actual shadow of the homes they aspired one day to own. On the corner of Main and Pleasant Streets was the Friends' immense South Meeting House, built in 1792 from pieces of the even bigger Great Meeting House that once loomed over the stoneless field of the Quaker burial ground at the end of Main Street. Just because Nickerson had been brought up a Congregationalist didn't mean he had never been inside this or the other Quaker meeting house on Broad Street. One visitor claimed that almost half the people who attended a typical Quaker meeting were not members of the Society of Friends. Earlier that summer, on June 29th, Obed Macy recorded that 2,000 people, more than a quarter of the island's population, had attended a public Quaker meeting at the South Meeting House. While many of the attendees were there for the good of their souls, those in their teens and early 20s tended to have other motives. No other place on Nantucket offered a better opportunity for young people to meet members of the opposite sex. Nantucketer Charles Murphy described in a poem how young men, such as himself, used the long gaps of silence, typical of a Quaker meeting, to sit with eager eyes directed on all the beauty there collected, and gaze with wonder while in sessions on all the various forms and fashions. Yet another gathering spot for amorous young people was the ridge of hills behind the town where the four windmills stood. Here, couples could enjoy a spectacular view of the town and Nantucket Harbor, with a brand new lighthouse at the end of Great Point visible in the distance. What is surprising is how rarely Nantucketers, even young and adventurous Nantucketers like Nickerson and company, strayed beyond the gates of the little town. As small as the island is, one whale oil merchant admitted in a letter, I was never at the extreme east or west, and for some years, I dare say, have not been 1 mile from town. In a world of whales, sea serpents, and ominous signs in the night sky, all Nantucketers, whalemen and landsmen alike, looked to the town as a sanctuary, a fenced-in place of familiar ways and timeless ancestral alliances, a place to call home. Passions stirred beneath Nantucket's Quaker facade. Life might seem restrained and orderly as hundreds, sometimes thousands of people made their way to meeting each Thursday and Sunday, the men in their long dark coats and wide-brimmed hats, the women in long dresses and meticulously crafted bonnets. But factors besides Quakerism and a common heritage also drove the Nantucket psyche, in particular, an obsession with the whale. No matter how much the inhabitants might try to hide it, there was a savagery about this island, a bloodlust and pride that bound every mother, father, and child in a clannish commitment to the hunt. The imprinting of a young Nantucketer began at the earliest age. The first words a baby was taught included the language of the chase. Taunor, for instance, a Wampanoag word meaning that the whale has been sighted for a second time. Bedtime stories told of killing whales and eluding cannibals in the Pacific. One mother approvingly recounted how her 9-year-old son attached a fork to the end of a ball of darning cotton and then proceeded to harpoon the family cat. The mother happened into the room just as the terrified pet attempted to escape, and unsure of what she had found herself in the middle of, she picked up the cotton ball. Like a veteran boat steerer, the boy shouted, "Pay out, mother! Pay out! There she sounds through the window." There was rumored to be a secret society of young women on the island whose members pledged to marry only men who had already killed a whale. To help these young women identify them as hunters, boat steerers wore chalk pins, small oak pins used to keep the harpoon line in the bow groove of a whaleboat, on their lapels. Boat steerers, superb athletes with prospects of lucrative captaincies, were considered the most eligible of Nantucket bachelors. Instead of toasting a person's health, a Nantucketer offered invocations of a darker sort. Death to the living, long life to the killers, success to sailors' wives, and greasy luck to whalers. Despite the bravado of this little ditty, death was a fact of life with which all Nantucketers were thoroughly familiar. In 1810, there were 47 fatherless children on Nantucket, while almost a quarter of the women over the age of 23, the average age of marriage, had been widowed by the sea. In old age, Nickerson still visited the graves of his parents in the old North burial ground. In 1819, during the last few weeks before his departure aboard the Essex, He undoubtedly made his way to this fenced-in patch of sun-scorched grass and walked among its canted stones. Nickerson's father had been the first of the parents to die on November 9, 1806, at the age of 33. His gravestone read, "Crushed as the moth beneath thy hand, we molder to the dust. Our feeble powers can ne'er withstand, and all our beauties lost." Nickerson's mother, who had borne 5 children, died less than a month later at the age of 28. Her oldest living daughter was 8 years old. Her only son was not yet 2. Her inscription read, "This mortal life decays apace. How soon the bubbles broke. Adam and all his numerous race are vanity and smoke." Nickerson, who was raised by his grandparents, wasn't the only orphan aboard the Essex. His friend Barzillai Ray had also lost both his parents. Owen Coffin and Charles Ramsdell had each lost a father. This may have been their closest bond. Each of them, like so many Nantucketers, was a fatherless child for whom a ship's officer would be much more than a demanding taskmaster. He would be quite possibly the first male authority figure the boys had ever known. Perhaps no community before or since has been so divided by its commitment to work. For a whaleman and his family, it was a punishing regimen. 2 to 3 years away, 3 to 4 months at home. With their men gone for so long, Nantucket's women were obliged not only to raise the children, but also to run many of the island's businesses. It was largely the women who maintained the complex web of personal and commercial relationships that kept the community functioning. J. Hector St. John de Crèvecoeur, whose classic Letters from an American Farmer describes his lengthy stay on the island a few years prior to the outbreak of the Revolution, suggested that the Nantucket women's prudence and good management justly entitles them to a rank superior to that of other wives. Quakerism contributed to the women's strength. In its emphasis on the spiritual and intellectual equality of the sexes, the religion fostered an attitude that was in keeping with what all Nantucketers saw plainly demonstrated to them every day, that women, who on Nantucket tended to be better educated than the island's men, were just as intelligent, just as capable as their male counterparts. By necessity and choice, the island's women maintained active social lives, visiting one another with a frequency Crèvecoeur described as incessant. These visits involved more than the exchange of mere gossip. They were the setting in which much of the business of the town was transacted. The 19th-century feminist Lucretia Coffin Mott, who was born and raised on Nantucket, remembered how a husband back from a voyage commonly followed in the wake of his wife, accompanying her to get-togethers with other wives. Mott, who eventually moved to Philadelphia, commented on how odd such a practice would have struck anyone from the mainland, where the sexes operated in entirely different social spheres. Some of the Nantucket wives adapted quite well to the 3 years away, 3 months at home rhythm of the whale fishery. The islander Eliza Brock recorded in her journal what she called the Nantucket Girl's Song. "Then I'll haste to wed a sailor and send him off to sea, for a life of independence is the pleasant life for me. But every now and then I shall like to see his face, for it always seems to me to beam with manly grace, with his brow so nobly open and his dark and kindly eye. Oh, my heart beats fondly towards him whenever he is nigh. But when he says goodbye, my love, I'm off across the sea. First I cry for his departure, then laugh, because I'm free." The mantle of power and responsibility settled upon the Nantucket woman's shoulders on her wedding day. "No sooner have they undergone the ceremony," said Crèvecoeur, "than they cease to appear so cheerful and gay. The new rank they hold in the society impresses them with more serious ideas than were entertained before. The new wife gradually advises and directs the household. The new husband soon goes to sea. He leaves her to learn and exercise the new government in which she is entered." To the undying outrage of subsequent generations of Nantucket loyalists, Crèvecoeur claimed that many of the island's women had developed an addiction to opium. "They have adopted these many years the Asiatic custom of taking a dose of opium every morning, and so deeply rooted is it that they would be at a loss how to live without this indulgence." Why they took the drug is perhaps impossible to determine from this distance in time. Still, the portrait that emerges of a community of achievers attempting to cope with a potentially devastating loneliness makes the women's dependence on opium perhaps easier to understand. The ready availability of the drug on the island, opium was included in every whale ship's medical chest, combined with the inhabitants' wealth may also help to explain why the drug was so widely used in Nantucket. There is little doubt that intimacy, physical as well as emotional, between a wife and a husband must have been difficult to establish under the tremendously compressed circumstances of the few months available between voyages. An island tradition claims that Nantucket women dealt with their husbands' long absences by relying on sexual aids known as he's-at-homes. Although this claim, like that of drug use, seems to fly in the face of the island's staid Quaker reputation, in 1979 a 6-inch plaster penis, along with a batch of letters from the 19th century and a laudanum bottle, was discovered hidden in the chimney of a house in the island's historic district. Just because they were superior wives didn't mean that the island's women were without normal physical desires. Like their husbands, Nantucket's women were ordinary human beings, attempting to adapt to a most extraordinary way of life. Thomas Nickerson may have enjoyed his first moments aboard the Essex, exploring her dark, hot interior, but the thrill was soon over. For the next 3 weeks, during the warmest summer anyone could remember, Nickerson and the gradually accumulating crew of the Essex labored to prepare the ship. Even in winter, Nantucket's wharves, topped by a layer of oil-soaked sand, stank to the point that people said you didn't see Nantucket when you first rounded the lighthouse at Brant Point. You smelled it. That July and August, the stench rising from the wharf must have been pungent enough to gag even a veteran whaleman. At that time on Nantucket, it was standard practice to have the newly signed members of a whale ship's crew help prepare the vessel for the upcoming voyage. Nowhere else in New England was a sailor expected to help rig and provision his ship. That was what riggers, stevedores, and provisioners were for. But on Nantucket, whose Quaker merchants were famous for their ability to cut costs and increase profits, a different standard prevailed. Whalemen did not work for wages. They were paid a share, or lay, a predetermined portion of the total take, at the end of the voyage. This meant that whatever work a ship owner could extract from a sailor prior to a voyage was, in essence, free, or to Nickerson's mind, a donation of labor on the part of the sailor. A ship owner might advance a seaman some money to help him purchase the clothing and equipment necessary for the voyage, but it was deducted, with interest, from his lay at the conclusion of the voyage. As cabin boy, Thomas Nickerson had what was known as a very long or meager lay. Although the ship papers from the Essex's 1819 voyage have vanished, we know that Nickerson's predecessor, the cabin boy Joseph Underwood of Salem, received a 1/190th lay for the previous voyage. Given that the Essex's cargo of 1,200 barrels of sperm oil sold for about $26,500, Underwood was paid, once the expenses of the voyage were deducted from the gross and his personal expenses were deducted from his own portion, a grand total of about $150 for 2 years' work. Although this was a pitiful wage, the cabin boy had been provided with room and board for 2 years, and now had the experience to begin a career as a whaleman. By the end of July, the Essex's upper works, just about everything at deck level and above, had been completely rebuilt, including a new layer of pine decking and a cookhouse. At some point, probably before Nickerson joined the crew, the Essex was laid over on her side for coppering. Immense block-and-tackle systems were strung from the ship's masts to the wharf to haul the ship onto her side. The exposed bottom was then sheathed in copper to protect the ship from marine growth, which could turn her 4-inch-thick oak hull planking into a soft, porous veneer. At 20 years of age, the Essex was reaching the point when many vessels began to exhibit serious structural deterioration. Whale oil seems to have acted as a preservative, providing most whale ships with lives much longer than that of a typical merchant vessel. Still, there were limits. Rot, teredo worms, and a condition called iron sickness, in which the ship's rusted iron fastenings weakened the oak, were all potential problems. The ever-lengthening voyages around Cape Horn were another concern. The ships being so long at sea without much repairs, Obed Macy would write in his journal, must shorten the durations of the ships by many years. Indeed, the Essex had undergone several days of repairs in South America during her previous voyage. She was an old ship, caught up in a new era of whaling, and no one knew how much longer she would last. Owners were always reluctant to invest any more money in the repair of a ship than was absolutely necessary. While they had no choice but to rebuild the Essex's upper works, there could well have been suspicious areas below the waterline that they chose to address at a later time, if not ignore. That summer, the Essex's principal owners, Gideon Folger and Sons, were awaiting delivery of a new, much larger whale ship, the Aurora. This was not the year to spend an inordinate amount of money on a tired old vessel like the Essex. Nantucket's ship owners could be as fierce in their own bloodless way as any whaleman. They might act the Quaker, but that didn't keep them from pursuing profits with a lethal enthusiasm. In Moby Dick, one of the Pequod's owners is Bildad, a pious Quaker whose religious scruples do not prevent him from extorting cruelly long lays from the crew. He offers Ishmael a 1/777th lay. With his Bible in one hand and ledger book in the other, Bildad resembles a lean, Quakerly John D. Rockefeller, his mind and soul devoted to the cold calculus of making a whaling voyage pay. There were some observers who claimed that, rather than leading the islanders to prosperity and grace, Quakerism was at the root of whatever evil flourished in the sharp business practices of Nantucket's shipowners. According to William Comstock, who penned an account of a whaling cruise from Nantucket in the 1820s, unfortunately, the anger which the Quakers are forbidden to express by outward actions, finding no vent, stagnates the heart, and while they make professions of love and goodwill, the rancor and intense malevolence of their feelings poisons every generous spring of human kindness. Gideon Folger and Paul Macy, two major shareholders in the Essex, were prominent members of the island's Quaker upper class. Yet, according to Nickerson, Macy, in charge of outfitting the Essex that summer of 1819, attempted to cut costs by severely under-provisioning the ship. In this practice, he was not alone. The owners of whale ships too frequently neglect to victual their ships properly, Comstock wrote, depending on the captain to stint his crew in proportion to his means, by which a few dollars are saved to the rich owners, while the poor, hard-laboring sailor famishes with hunger. While it would be unfair to point to Paul Macy as responsible, even in part, for the grief that eventually awaited the men of the Essex, the first step toward that future began with Macy's decision to save a little money in beef and hardtack. On Nantucket in the early 19th century, people didn't invest in bonds or the stock market, but rather in whale ships. By purchasing shares in several ships rather than putting their money in a single vessel, islanders spread both the risk and the reward throughout the community. Agents such as Macy and Folger could expect a total return on their whaling investments of somewhere between 28% and 44% per year. Making this level of profitability all the more remarkable was the state of the world's economy in 1819. As Nantucket continued to add ship after ship to her fleet, mainland businesses were collapsing by the hundreds. Claiming that the days of our fictitious affluence is past, a Baltimore newspaper reported that spring on dishonored credits, deserted dwellings, inactive streets, declining commerce, and exhausted coffers. Nantucket remained an astonishing exception. Just as its isolated situation many miles out to sea enabled it to enjoy the warming influence of the Gulf Stream, providing for the longest growing season in the region, Nantucket existed, at least for the time being, in its own benign climate of prosperity. Between July 4th and July 23rd, 10 whale ships left the island, most heading out in pairs. The wharves were busy with laborers long into the night, all caught up in the disciplined frenzy of preparing whale ships for sea. But Gideon Folger, Paul Macy, and the Essex's captain, George Pollard, knew that all the preparations would be for naught if they couldn't find a crew of 21 men. Since there were only so many Nantucketers to go around, ship owners relied on off-islanders with no previous sailing experience, known as green hands, to man their vessels. Many came from nearby Cape Cod. Shipping agents in cities up and down the East Coast also provided the owners with green hands, often sending them to Nantucket in groups aboard packet ships. A green hand's first impression of the island was seldom positive. The young boys loitering on the waterfront inevitably harassed the new arrivals with the cry, "See the greenies come to go isling." Oil was pronounced isle on Nantucket. Then followed a walk from Strait Wharf to the base of Main Street, where a clothing and dry goods store served as the grand resort and rendezvous of seafaring men. Here, men looking for a berth or just killing time, known as watching the pass on Nantucket, spent the day in a haze of tobacco smoke, lounging on an assortment of benches and wooden boxes. On this island of perpetual motion, job-seeking seamen were expected to whittle. It was the way a man whittled that let people know what kind of berth he expected. A whaleman with at least one voyage under his belt knew enough to draw his knife always away from him. This signaled that he was looking for a boat steerer's berth. Boat steerers, on the other hand, whittled in the opposite direction, toward themselves. This indicated that they believed they were ready to become a mate. Not knowing the secret codes that Nantucketers had developed, a green hand simply whittled as best he knew how. Many of the green hands felt as if they had found themselves in a foreign country where the people spoke a different language. All Nantucketers, even the women and little children, used nautical terms as if they were able-bodied seamen. According to one visitor, every child can tell which way the wind blows, and any old woman in the street will talk of cruising about, hailing an old messmate, or making one bring two, as familiarly as the captain of a whale ship, just arrived from the northwest coast, will describe dimension to a landlubber by the span of his jibboom or the length of his mainstay. For the green hands, whose first taste of the sea may have been on the packet ship to Nantucket, it was all a bewildering blur, particularly since many of the islanders also employed the distinctive thee and thou phrasing of the Quakers. Compounding the confusion was the Nantucketer's accent. It wasn't just isle for oil. There was a host of peculiar pronunciations, many of which varied markedly from what was found even as nearby as Cape Cod and the island of Martha's Vineyard. A Nantucket whaleman kept his clothing in a chist. His harpoons were kept sherp, especially when attacking a large whale. A keppin had his own kebin, and was more often than not a married man, while a met kept the ship's log for the entire voyage. Then there were all these strange phrases that a Nantucketer used. If he bungled a job, it was a faux pas, an apparent corruption of the French faux pas that dated back to the days after the Revolution, when Nantucketers established a whaling operation in Dunkirk, France. A Nantucketer didn't just go for a walk on a Sunday afternoon, he went on a random scoot, which meant an excursion with no definite destination. Fancy victuals were known as manavolins. If someone was cross-eyed, he was born in the middle of the week and looking both ways for Sunday. Green hands were typically subjected to what one man remembered as a sort of examination by both the ship owner and the captain. Recalled another, "We were catechized, in brief, concerning our nativity and previous occupation, and the build and physical points of each were looked to, not forgetting the eyes, for a sharp-sighted man was a jewel in the estimation of the genuine whaling captain." Some green hands were so naive and poorly educated that they insisted on the longest lay possible, erroneously thinking that the higher number meant higher pay. The owners were all too willing to grant their wishes. Whaling captains competed with one another for men, but as with everything on Nantucket, there were specific rules to which everyone had to adhere. Since first-time captains were expected to defer to all others, the only men available to Captain Pollard of the Essex would have been those in whom no one else had an interest. By the end of July, Pollard and the owners were still short by more than half a dozen men. On August 4th, Obed Macy stopped by the Marine Insurance Company at the corner of Main and Federal Streets to look at the thermometer mounted on its shingled exterior. In his journal, he recorded 93 degrees and very little wind, which has rendered it almost insupportable to be exposed to the rays of the sun. The next day, August 5th, the fully rigged Essex was floated over the Nantucket Bar into deep water. Now, the loading could begin in earnest, and a series of smaller craft called lighters began ferrying goods from the wharf to the ship. First to be stowed were the ground-tier casks, large iron-hooped containers each capable of holding 268 gallons of whale oil. They were filled with seawater to keep them swollen and tight. On top of these were stowed casks of various sizes filled with fresh water. Firewood took up a great deal of space, as did the thousands of shooks, or packed bundles of staves, which would be used by the ship's cooper to create more oil casks. On top of that was enough food, all stored in casks, to last 2.5 years. If the men were fed the same amount as merchant seamen, which is perhaps assuming too much when it came to a Nantucket whaler, the Essex would have contained at least 14 tons of meat, salt beef and pork, more than 8 tons of bread, and thousands of gallons of fresh water. Then there were massive amounts of whaling equipment, harpoons, lances, etc., as well as clothing, charts, sails, including at least one spare set, navigational instruments, medicine, rum, gin, lumber, and so on. In addition to the 3 newly painted whaleboats that were suspended from the ship's davits, there were at least 2 spare boats, one stored upside down on a rack over the quarterdeck, another mounted on spare spars that projected over the stern. By the time the men were done loading the Essex 6 days later, their labors briefly interrupted by a tremendous shower of rain duly noted by Obed Macy on August 9th, the ship was almost as heavily laden as it would be with whale oil on her return to Nantucket. Explained one Nantucketer, "The gradual consumption of provisions and stores keeps pace with the gradual accumulation of oil, and a whale ship is always full, or nearly so, all the voyage." Something, however, was still missing. The men needed to fill the 7 empty berths in the Essex's forecastle. At some point, Gideon Folger put out the call to an agent in Boston for as many black sailors as the agent could find. Although he wasn't black, Addison Pratt came to Nantucket under circumstances similar to the ones that brought 7 African Americans to the island and to service on the Essex. In 1820, Pratt found himself in Boston looking for a ship. "I soon commenced hunting for a voyage, but it was dull times with commerce, as seamen's wages were but $10 per month, and there were more sailors than ships in port, and I found it dull times for green hands. But after looking around for a few days, I heard there were hands wanted to go on a whaling voyage to the Pacific Ocean. I made no delay, but hastened to the office and put down my name and received $12 of advance money, which I laid out in sea clothes. 6 more hands were shipped for the same vessel, and we were all sent on board of a packet bound to Nantucket." As Pratt's account suggests, a whaling voyage was the lowest rung on the maritime ladder for a seaman. Nantucketers like Thomas Nickerson and his friends might look to their first voyage as a necessary step in the beginning of a long and profitable career. But for the men who were typically rounded up by shipping agents in cities such as Boston, it was a different story. Instead of the beginning of something, shipping out on a whaling voyage was often a last and desperate resort. The 7 black sailors who agreed to sign on for a voyage aboard the Essex, Samuel Reed, Richard Peterson, Lawson Thomas, Charles Shorter, Isaiah Shepherd, William Bond, and Henry DeWitt, had even fewer choices than Addison Pratt would in 1820. None of their names appear in Boston or New York directories from this period, indicating that they were not landowners. Whether or not they called Boston home, most of them had probably spent more than a few nights in the boarding houses in the waterfront area of the north end of the city, a place notorious as a gathering place for itinerant seamen, black and white, looking for a berth. As they boarded the packet for Nantucket, the 7 African Americans knew at least one thing. They might not be paid well for their time aboard a Nantucket whaler, but they were assured of being paid no less than a white person with the same qualifications. Since the time when Native Americans had made up the majority of Nantucket's labor force, the island's ship owners had always paid men according to their rank, not their color. Some of this had to do with the Quakers' anti-slavery leanings, but much of it also had to do with the harsh realities of shipboard life. In a tight spot, a captain didn't care if a seaman was white or black. He just wanted to know he could count on the man to complete his appointed task. Still, black sailors who were delivered to the island as green hands were never regarded as equals by Nantucketers. In 1807, a visitor to the island reported, "The Indians having disappeared, Negroes are now substituted in their place. Seamen of color are more submissive than the whites, but as they are more addicted to frolicking, it is difficult to get them aboard the ship when it is about to sail, and to keep them aboard after it has arrived. The Negroes, though they are to be prized for their habits of obedience, are not as intelligent as the Indians, and none of them attain the rank of boat steerer or mate." It wasn't lofty social ideals that brought black sailors to this Quaker island, but rather the whale fishery's insatiable and often exploitative hunger for labor. "An African is treated like a brute by the officers of their ship," reported William Comstock, who had much to say about the evils of Nantucket's Quaker shipowners. "Should these pages fall into the hands of any of my colored brethren, let me advise them to fly Nantucket as they would the Norway maelstrom." Even Nickerson admitted that Nantucket whaling captains had a reputation as Negro drivers. Significantly, Nantucketers referred to the packet that delivered greenhands from New York City as the Slaver. By the evening of Wednesday, August 11th, all save for Captain Pollard were safely aboard the Essex. Anchored beside her, just off the Nantucket bar, was another whale ship, the Chile. Commanded by Absalom Coffin, the Chile was also to leave the following day. It was an opportunity for what whalemen referred to as a gam, a visit between two ships' crews. Without the captains to inhibit the revelry, and with the bar between them and town, they may have seized this chance for a final uproarious fling before the grinding discipline of shipboard life took control of their lives. At some point that evening, Thomas Nickerson made his way down to his bunk and its mattress full of mildewed corn husks. As he faded off to sleep on the gently rocking ship, he surely felt what one young whaleman described as a great, almost overwhelming